So my name is Bob Schindelbeck. I'm an extension associate. I live in Ithaca, so I work right at Cornell. I don't know how many folks are here last night, but that's the land-grant college for New York. So we've got a soil testing lab there that's been there since the 40s or 50s. And just recently, since 2011, we merged soil health, the soil health lab, with the nutrient analysis lab, which is what it used to be. We're kind of like a sister lab to that. There's only so much interest and in need for the basic testing that the old lab did, and the soil health is kind of the new thinking in soil science, at least bringing it to a usable form for folks. So what I'm going to talk today about is this framework for soil health, really understanding, and I show a problem field here leading to a grower, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the grower I show here. I hope it's a guy, he doesn't look dumb, he's not meant to. What he is a person with a lot of questions. He's wondering what are my options, what might I do? We argue, and part of our protocol here is the idea that the soil processes, these things the soil has to do, we can measure those. And also those soil processes, we can manage those. So it gives us an insight. If we think of the processes, we can relate them. Everything relates back to the process, and it gives us a tool to then think about either direction. So we've been at this. We actually offered our first soil health test in 2007. When we put out our first training manual, this is edition 2, came out in 2009. We now have a brand new 2016 soil health manual. I'll pass a couple of these around. I'll go one over here, one here. A whole lot of information in there, and everything is available online as free downloads. Anything I show, I'll show these books online with their links to, as I say, free downloads. They're all relatively inexpensive publications if you would want it. I think they're all $20 or somewhere around there. I'm using this soil health testing as a framework for talking about soil health processes, really. And the product of, at least from the laboratory, is this soil health test report. It's very comprehensive. I should say that down here, these are the chemical nutrients. So this is an old soil test, would have been just from here down. What we've done is added this biological aspect and soil physical aspect to the testing of the soil. And I note this is page 1. This is a 10-page report. This is the summary page. And behind it, I'll show that later, all the backstopping information to define some of the terms, what they are, what's it measuring, kind of a condensate of the first half of this talk. We've made a new logo over this last winter. We've got an artist in our group, and you'll see why we like those three leaves in just a moment. Okay, this is the front page of your handout. Your handout is two-sided. The first one is the talks about the initial part of the testing of this soil management, and that's the testing. So it lists here some of the features. It talks about the physical, chemical, and biological testing over here. How, of course, soil health is in the middle where these three discs overlap. Of course, we call soil health actually soil ecology, which is an interaction of all these pieces. Certainly, as scientists, what we do is we dissect. So the first thing we do is pull it apart, but as I say, always with the object in mind to put it back together. So we measure all these processes. Then we even give a color coding rating. So this is a report here. I'll go into this later. I don't want to jump ahead later. So each of these tests then is given a value from the laboratory in this column. Then the next column gives us a color-coded score, just like you'd want from your doctor. If you had a serotonin level of 200, you'd want to know, is that good or bad? And that would come with, if that came with a color coding, that would help you identify if that's low or high or medium, whatever. And then what I'll talk in the second half of the talk is the management suggestions. So we go from this then, we provide some linkages to some of the constrained functions, these processes that don't seem up to snuff where they could be. We make some loose beginning suggestions on what you might do. should mention, here are the soil indicators that we test. Of course, the processes that they're associated with, that's what we're testing. They're essential soil processes. Here's a quick picture of all the different tests themselves. I'll hit on these briefly as we talk, but it was important when we developed this, I think you can read this on your handout, that these tests that we use are sensitive to management, they're meaningful, they're testing something that's important. We always wanted some sort of a quantitative information back, not just qualitative, so we try to get as quantitative as we can, wanted them standardized, and updating them with current research. We've changed our tests. In 2014, we swapped out some tests and swapped in some what we think are better tests. And we think it's inexpensive. It's $95 for this suite of tests. Of course, the standard nutrients is $15. So it's significantly more than that. But we're a nonprofit, and that's really what it costs. Part two is putting it together. Again, here's the soil processes and these tests that the port report is focusing on. I call that the foundation. Of course, all these things interact. The management to assist the grower, that's what we're really about. We want to help the grower understand what's going on in the soil, low or high. When he tries something new, he can get results back that can inform him how it's going. Our big idea is to identify constraints. So if you notice here, when we have our different indicators, they're measured, and you see some text over on the far right here. That text appears automatically when anything is in the very low range, suggesting a constraint, something that ought to really get your attention. And again, I'll show later how in the back parts of the report we talk about management suggestions. But first, we've got a six-step process here to kind of take all this information, all this soil testing information, and combine it with the grower themselves. So the first three steps here really is about the grower. Who is the grower? Where is it? What kind of land is it? What is their operation? Of course, you need to set goals and sample to ask your questions. So what questions do you have? You want to line those out strategically. At $100 a test, you're not just taking a bunch of samples and seeing what it gives you. You strategize ahead. You get so much more back from the testing then. And then come up with from what's given back to kind of come up with possible things you might do. Those are the first three steps that you kind of get to just with a report in hand. But then to put that together for the grower, this usually takes a one-on-one, not by us, but someone, the grower, maybe with another part of themselves, where they talk about what they might do, pros and cons of that, see what's available locally, bounce that off different people. And then you can kind of, in these margins here, just kind of jot things you'd like to try or find out more about at the farm show, or next time you're at the seed dealer, you've heard about something at a meeting like this, and you want to check and see, can we get that seed here, and how would I do it? That's what you can do when you're in the off season or anytime you're out. You're always asking these questions then so that you can get back and enable you to do, hopefully, your best job. Right, so I talked about those three spheres there that we'll focus on, and of course it's balance that we're after. Anything that's out of range will upset the whole thing. That's what the three-legged stool there is about. But we want to know if all three legs are sound or if one has a weakness. So this is an adage from the old days of soil testing. If you can't measure it, you can't know it. So we do want to measure so that we can identify any problems, any constraints, so that we can optimize our management. I promised to talk about soil processes. I wasn't kidding. I'll start with the soil chemical processes and functions. I put with the chemical here that's in the yellow, I put a picture of meat and potatoes because that really is the basis for understanding soil, certainly historically. We've always tested that. Most folks know that the pH governs a lot of solubility of ions in soil. So the soil literally dissolves, typically it dissolves in acid. So if you have an acid soil, you're dissolving the metals into solution from the mineral itself. If it's more basic, you might not be able to get those metals, particularly something like iron. Your soil might have a lot of iron, but the pH is very high, the iron is not available. if you lowered the pH, that iron could become available. The pH always very important, particularly for the micronutrients. But just nutrient storage, nutrient release, there's a big body of knowledge. We really have that kind of down pat. I don't spend a lot of time talking about that. We've got a pretty good handle on soil chemical needs and for crop production, plant production. But the difference is the old context said, use this fertilizer. And the new context says, you're going to have to get it a different way. That's what this is all about, getting it a different way. And that takes us right to the soil biology. That's the soil life. Everyone should know that organic matter is something that was once alive. The soil, I can tell you what the soil on the moon is like. If you went to a place on Earth where there was never anything growing, never, that would be moon soil. There's nothing alive in it. So organic matter really is the history, if you examine the organic matter carefully, it's a history of what has ever lived there. Of course, time can erase life, but in a general way, that's when we talk about organic matter, we talk about things that were in farming most recently alive. And of course, roots and plant dead debris feeds the microbial community, but so does the living plant, also feeds the microbial community. There's forever a battle underground of organisms vying for life and killing others in that process of living. And that then is where the organic matter decomposition comes in. Organic matter is a source of life for the next order organism. So that said, we want organic matter to decompose, even though you'll think that we want to save it. I'll talk about that later. But we really do want to promote this healthy life and death of the soil underground. Of course, most of our nitrogen that's released from the soil comes from something that was once alive. So nitrogen mineralization means nitrogen is coming from an organic form to an available form. That's what the word mineralization means. Pest suppression, an active, vibrant soil with lots of turnover, resists the growth of pests because most pests simply can't compete with a healthy soil biome. And finally, the soil physical arena. I'm a soil physicist. This is most of my demonstrations. We'll talk about this. This is the house where all this takes place. This is where the roots are. This is where the plant's going to live. So the soil physical environment has to be conducive to holding the plant up and having a place for its roots. And, of course, it has to stay in place. It can't erode away. So we need something that's a house. But this, what does this house do? Well, just like for us, it's a place where water is stored. And first we have to get water in and store it for plants to use. Roots are animals. They're attached to a plant. They need everything an animal needs, so you've got to get oxygen in there or they won't make it. Anytime a soil is full of water and it drains, fresh air follows. So after a rain, or when it's raining, you can smell the soil. That's true, because the water that went in pushed the old air out to make room for the water. Then as that water goes in, behind it comes fresh air. So you smell the nice earth smell, and they taste the fresh air. So no wonder things happen right after a rain. And, of course, this house, the roots have to be able to move through it to get these nutrients, to access this water. So those are the three ways we tease this ecology apart, the soil health, with the idea that we're putting it back together. So the old adage of nutrient testing was managed for the most limiting factor. So we've got a barrel here with the water in it. It's getting only so high, that's yield. And this shows nitrogen. So where nitrogen limits plant growth, that's where the yield spills out. You don't get any more yield in the barrel. If you were to add more nitrogen, the next lowest stave would be phosphorus. That would be the next thing to address, to add phosphorus. So this is how this limiting factor to address that is something we've always done. It's a standard troubleshooting approach. There's nothing wrong with this approach. And our soil testing had always done that. But now we think we should apply the same strategy, and we do, to the soil health testing, because it's more than just these nutrients. If the soil is, for example, compacted, you can have a lot of nutrients there, and they simply can't be gotten by the roots from the plant. All right, so this is the same slide I showed before, but with each of these ideas here, I put the tests that we use to measure that. Here we are again. I want to make this point. This is a soil. Actually, we're going to demonstrate this soil. This is a soil that, looking at it, you'd say, oh, that's in pretty tough shape. That doesn't look real good. It's a very intensively used, we call it our home soil. It's on the edge of campus. There's a plant breeding group that does genetic seed, right? They keep their lines going of their seed stocks. And so they grow small grains every year. And that's just what they do. That's okay. But the soil, you can kind of see it. It sure looks like it needs help. But this is the soil health test report from that. And if you notice, I said down here was all the nutrients. All the nutrients are A-OK. So if you did a standard soil test on this soil, it'd say, good to go. It'd say, maybe add a little starter fertilizer, but that's it. And you'd be missing a lot of information. You could say, oh, I know that soil needs more than need some other help, that's okay, but this is just what we do. We're trying to measure those things then, where you might help you focus on what's the most limiting in terms of the measurements. Kind of interesting, right? This is really eye-opening for us, and when we do our database, we've done a lot of work with a big data set, and we find this over and over, that nutrients are not the problem. It's these other functions. Of course, the reasons the nutrients are up to snuff is because of salt, mineral fertilizers people have added over the years. It does, organic management opens a slightly different can of worms, but still it can't be denied that you do need these sufficiency levels to grow. And so now how do we get those with the organic sources only complicates the task, but I wouldn't think of it as complicating in a bad sense. So here's these indicators again in a more of a table form with the colors, the yellow, the green, the blue. And I've circled these soil physical processes here and these tests. I'm going to move into that now. Right, so here's a soil aggregate idealized. So this is a crumb of soil. This is approaching almost clod size, but you can see this, it's some fraction of an inch. Imagine even some part of this. In fact, at different scales, it's all the same. You see these very small individual, let's call those sand and silt and clay grains, if you will, or small aggregates, put together into a big unit. And within this unit, it's very important, this aggregation is so important, because of these different size pores that result from this. Everyone should know that when it rains, particularly if it rains hard, these large pores can get water into the soil very quickly. We always want the water to go in where it lands. If water is running from one area to another, not only do you end up with typically a lack of water later, the spot it ran off from, but you overburden the areas downstream or downhill. So these different sized pores are hugely important for water storage, air storage. It creates fissures and openings for organisms, think of earthworms, roots, etc. These aggregates are just, you can't say enough about the aggregates themselves, but also the pores where the water is stored. So these larger pores are drained by gravity. Right? They do their work during the storm. Soon thereafter, they empty. Because of gravity, they're so big, they can't hold it. This crumb here, the small spaces between the particles, based on their size, they store water for different amounts of time. The smallest pores hold the water the longest. So the first water that, if you think of it that way, if you think the first water the roots might use is this next intermediate pore. But several days after the rain, as the soil dries further, this one will then be empty. And these very, very, very tiny ones may never empty, or only very late in an extended dry period. So we like the idea of aggregates and for all these things they do with the water storage. And I can't resist this. We have magnifying glasses on campus. I didn't bring mine. I forgot it. But what this is the soil crumb, pretty much this clod here, what I have here. And they've taken, this is a textbook, Brady and Wiles, kind of the Bible of soil science. They've taken this little square here and magnified it 10 times up and done that repeatedly, another square, magnified 10 times up. And what I'm really trying to show here is that each scale, it's the same thing. What we see, these, well, there's hairs here and little pieces of this and that, organic debris. The ant sees the same thing. We might not see some of this stuff. It might be just like little hairs that we might even miss. But, of course, at any scale, it's kind of the same idea. So we've got in here then, in this little piece, 10 times down, 100 times down, 1,000 times down, there's still big and small pores where water is stored for different amounts of time. Water channels are there. Different sized pieces, an insect leg would, at this magnification, that's what it would look like, or human hair would look like this. But this is just to give you an idea of scale, and what you could expect is in a well-managed soil that's got lots of organic debris in it, you do have all these different things that you could identify if you got down and looked at it. And that's what the diversity is, because these things will persist at different lengths of time. The leg might last longer than that hair-sized root, or reversed, and that's all important, because somewhere there may be a root going in this vicinity. And because of the water stored here in this insect leg, the root can continue to grow in this direction. Remember, roots grow opportunistically. They don't know what they're doing. They're blind. And so they're just growing along. And if there's moisture here, it's going to, in its own way, grow towards it. There's no moisture here. It's not going to grow in that direction. So we always want to create opportunities for the plant to obtain what it needs. All right, so this is a bigger picture of the soil on the edge of campus. This is intensive cropping. That's the same photo. This kind of shows the structure of these clods. In fact, the words you'd use for soil like this is that it is cloddy. When you plow it, it often comes up cloddy, and then it dries a little bit, and you go to smooth it down, and it doesn't. These clods become very hard. Sometimes this soil is called a minute soil because 1 minute it's too wet. You see, it's kind of greasy, it's kind of wet, and the next minute it's too dry, particularly when it's been plowed in this state. If you hit it just right, if you're basically out there waiting on a breezy spring day, you hit it at just the right time, and you can break some of these clods down to get a seedbed. But if you don't hit it at the right time, either too early or too late, either you can do nothing or make them bigger and worse. And 100 feet away, it's the same soil. So these are identical twins. This is sod, a sod area, it's pasture, I just flipped over to kind of show the difference. So you can see that these identical twins were raised under different parental management, and you can see what can happen to that soil. And so what this really illustrates, too, is this idea of benchmarking. If this is my field, if I could, and I wonder, well, what's going on with this field? What are the numbers on my field? It's nice to take a second sample as a contrast. We would call this benchmarking idea maybe underneath the fence at the edge of the field. This would tell you the native capacity of the soil. Surprising sometimes that we can actually, with proper management, we can make the soil, you can imagine a flower garden, always. I can't imagine a lawn that could ever compare to a flower garden in terms of fertility and tilth and structure. On a farm, it's a little different. I can't bring in a wheelbarrow for every 30 square feet. Like I can in a garden. But the idea is this contrast by having an A and a B and sampling both, I learn at least 10 times what I would learn from just one. And so I show the cloddy structure here. And this structure, you'd call it mellow, very friable. It's got good tilth. You can even see little pieces of root in here, debris root, little hairs coming out of these clods. Right, and so these clods, or these crumbs, this aggregation, is important for getting that water in, getting it stored, getting it out of the way. Where if these clods were to break down and kind of mush, go to mush like we see there, what we see there on the left, over here, these could just break down, and they can actually crust over. And you should note that anytime you have compaction of any kind, the pore sizes you lose first are the big ones. They're what we call macropores. That's how the soil breathes. They're very important to maintain. All right, so here's just a picture in the field of the sort of thing, just to give you a field idea. This dense surface area, because this is crusted now, these aggregates have broken down from crumbs and clods into just a mush, and it dries. This can dry hard. Of course, that's just a vicious cycle. The dry soil then this becomes very hard. So if you do have a little seedling here, now not only didn't get that water to loosen and moisten the soil, there's no water for it and it can't grow, and it's just a vicious cycle of not good. All right, so I've got this demonstration up here. I'll start this real quick. So this is that soil that I talked about, the intensive management. It's the same soil, different parts of the field. This is a clod here, about the same size. You can see a little root hair coming out of it. You might have seen this demonstration by NRCS. They're doing this recently. So I've got this little soil sieve here. I'm just going to drop into the water, about an inch deep. I'll put a clod from this intensively managed soil and a clod from the well-managed, the sod side. And you'll notice pretty quickly the clod that's dropped into the clod under the sod, I can tell you what's going to happen. It's just going to sit there. It's going to take in water and hold fast. This soil crumb will, as it takes in water, it doesn't have all those little insect legs and pieces of root, right? The pieces that would have been there that would have attracted an earthworm to go through this soil and have the slime from the earthworm come off onto the soil and help stick that soil together isn't there. And in 10 minutes, this piece will be gone as that mush at the bottom. Here. And this crumb will move, won't do anything. It'll take in that water, and it's as if the rain didn't even happen. And so what I did here, this is what the two soils looked like before the test. I did an inch of rain from the dark line down, and then an inch of rain applied to both sides at the same time. I get all this runoff from this, and you'll be able to see the crust that's up here when you come up after. We've got all this runoff, all this soil lost. And here we had very little water running off, and it's fairly clean. It's kind of just a little demonstration, but I think you get the idea of what an inch of rain can do to that poor soil. And in our lab, which we're going to demonstrate here, we do this in the laboratory on soil, bigger soil sieves. We put the soil from this on here, and this treatment here, and these are the stability numbers we get. 5/6 of this soil was broken down by the action of these raindrops during the test. The broken down soil is caught, and you can see this little filter paper here, catches that broken soil, and we'll weigh that later. On this side, over half of the soil remains, but almost half of it does break down. It's a very tender soil, anyway, and that'll be caught in the sieve there. And so we can determine what that is and actually put a number on this stability. So as I said, we're really quantitative. We want to get a number on some of these tests, on some of these processes. This allows us to say, if you're tracking something across time or different treatments, you can see if it's made an effect. And of course, this soil structure applies at the surface, and in this case, this is a subsurface problem, just a very dense soil. It's just got compaction at depth. And so this compaction down here doesn't allow the water to leave it. So if water does enter, it just sits there and puddles. So this looks like a surface, it becomes a surface problem, but it's actually the subsurface that's causing this. And, you know, this doesn't get moist, so it stays hard, or can stay hard, where typically when a soil moistens, it gets softer. So not only does the water enter for the plant and oxygen for the roots, but it also softens the soil. So we want the water to soften the soil so that the roots can grow right after that rain event. And, of course, this compaction can happen at the surface. That's that crusting. We're actually compacting. The rain's actually doing the compacting. We got plow layer compaction from machinery and some soil compaction from heavy machinery. And we test that with this use of this field penetrometer. If you're down at John Paul Cartens, he talked a lot about the soil penetrometer, or a little bit about it. This is a device that just measures the soil hardness. There's a little gauge here. You bounce around the field and see what the strength is from the 0 to 6-inch depth and 6 to 18-inch depth. One thing I didn't mention before is our test, the soil health test itself, we use the 0 to 6-inch depth of soil. But we want to know more about the subsurface, and this is one way to get some of that information. Just to find out if we've got restricted numbers down here, we can find it. We can pursue that then with a spade or a backhoe. Kind of what you see when you've got this plow layer compaction. Here's a plant that's trying to grow. Soil's very hard. The roots can't explore, so there's fertility in this clod. There's water. The roots can't get it. Often you see this because of the subsoil compaction. The roots grow fine where it's loose, and they just can't quite get deeper. If you're going to, you know, if you've got 6 inches of soil here, let's say that's at inch seven where this is, if you could add one more inch of good soil, it'd be 15% more water and nutrients. Okay, let's move on to the soil biological tests and processes. Yeah, I really like this slide. There's a lot here. So when we add organic matter to the soil, this really is what it's all about. Remember, it's moon soil. The earth is moon soil until we add the life. So organic matter, everyone, I think even kids know that adding organic matter increases biological activity and diversity. But I think we have to keep thinking about that. So what I did was I followed that down kind of at the right on the surface there, where, of course, as that decomposes, we're going to increase our aggregation. These blue are what I've talked about already. We're going to increase our soil aggregation, those crumbs. Our pore structure's improved, so we store more water. Soil's just a better house, leading to healthier plants. Same with the biology. As the soil biology decomposes, it's going to release nutrients that were once in that living tissue. Eventually, they become available again for other critters and the plants. We can detoxify other substances. We can outcompete organisms. But overarching all this is, what is the organic matter? If we had something that has particular features, let's say a legume that's very nitrogenous, we're going to spin these arrows more or less depending on what material we add. And this is the whole field of study of cover crops and cropping itself. What are the features of this, of mustards, that mustards don't, right, mustards have a lot of activity over here. So if we really want to push this part of it, we kind of look to mustards. Not that other things don't also help with this, but there's right, plants have characteristics that we can accentuate their effect, that have accentuated effects on this, and we can choose them appropriately. And we'll get to that in the management. So right, all organic matter is not created equal. Organic matter is different. It's different stuff, particularly fresh and stable, what we call stable, like a compost. So when you put fresh material on a soil, what you're actually doing is composting it out there. So all those things that happen early, think of a big pile of leaves in a pile, you stir it a couple times in the fall, by the spring, there's not much left. That's the fresh material actively feeding billions of organisms, and they're respiring a lot of that, not just compacting it, but a lot of that carbon that's in those leaves gets respired out as CO2. But we want that. We want to break that down. As these organisms are working, living and dying and bursting, they're stabilizing that soil material at the bottom of the pile. And as the material breaks down and you lose some of that carbon, you increase the availability of the nitrogen in it. And these are some tests that we measure those sort of features. Of course, stable material, if we put a compost then onto the field, all this has already happened. So if I had a soil that needed more stability, I'd look for fresh material, green manure, for example, so that as that broke down, I'd get a lot of this life, huge populations, and then they die. Think of each little organism as a water balloon that bursts. That goo, before it gets eaten by other creatures, helps bind the soil together. So you'd want to favor fresh material for certain features of soil behavior, and stable material has other, talents, other features that you might want to take advantage of. And you all know the soil food web idea, but these living and dying organisms, I can't stress enough this dying, you're breaking down debris, which is providing for the next organism, it's releasing nutrients, helping glue the soil together, suppressing pathogens. I just like this. It kind of brings a lot together with the mycorrhiza and the different symbioses here that I think we all know about with rhizobia and mycorrhiza. Yeah, so when plants are alive, they're also giving up parts of their body to feed the soil, not just leaves in the fall when actually that's the bed that the plant is making for itself over the winter. Just like a bird collects material and puts it in a nest, the tree does that, or a plant does it with its above-ground parts. It's doing that all the time with root hairs. As the root grows, these root hairs come out behind the root tip. And so a root hair is a single cell. It grows for a while, really increases the surface area, takes in a lot of nutrients because it increases all the surface area and it's so fine. At some point it dies. And then this contains the qualities of that plant. If that plant, that, and what that plant does is it imbues a taste to itself. Everything's got a taste. So if it wants to, right, it attracts certain organisms that like the taste of this and repels organisms that don't like the taste of it. And plants do this all the time. And so it's modifying which creatures are living around it. If this will play, I'm going to run over here and see if I can get this to play. This is a... Nope. Sorry about that. That was a slide that showed... Let me go back. As this root tip grows, this is a slide that was from Japan in the 80s. They used some film to capture a plant root growing, and the cells of the root are breaking off on this root tip, and they're entering into this solution around here. You can see all these protozoa and the nutrients from the root leaching out into this liquid. You can see the protozoa in here eating on these and bursting these cells of the plant. But I can't get it to play. Right, so we have one of our tests in the organic matter category is this active carbon that's the easily oxidizable organic matter. I'd call it kindling. So it's the very fine organic debris that critters like to eat. In our intensively managed soil, we've burned that all out with our tillage. It's all up in the air now as CO2. We've got some pieces of it here. There's some, fine roots and leaf tissue here. That fine material that's kindling, that will burn. And if it can burn, something can eat it and get that same energy. And so we have this test where we use this purple potassium permanganate. You put a little bit of soil in it and shake it for 8 minutes. And depending on the color that it turns, we can determine how much of this material is there. So we can kind of score the level of this kindling that's readily available food for the plants with this test. You can do this in the field too, is why I showed these. We weigh it, of course, precisely in the lab, but people do it by volume. But this is one that you can go out and use in the field. Obviously here there's a factor of 3, 280 to 330. So even if there was a little error with your sampling and doing it in the field, you'd still know if you're in the low or high range probably. We do a respiration test. A lot of talk about respiration these days. What respiration is, of course, is the breathing, the carbon dioxide from that breathing of the organisms. So we put a little soil in this little mason jar. We add some water, seal it up for 4 days, and then read how much carbon dioxide gets trapped in this strong base in here. We got another indicator, this soil protein test. Where am I here? Anyways, the soil protein test on the right, that gives us an indication of how much nitrogenous organic matter is there. So it kind of helps us speciate out the total organic matter into these different fractions. All right, so this is, we've talked about these, how we use the test to kind of figure out what's going on in our soil, these limitations. We did the analyses. We got the report in hand. We've worked on this foundation. Now what are we going to do about our management? How are we going to use the information? So I'll show in a moment. These ladder tables in this report are a linkage table of what soil management. Of course, our goal is to get this management plan working in concert with others sometimes to come up with your best case. Talked a little bit about asking your best question. Really important in the old days with nutrients. The strongest thing you've ever done for phosphorus in your field is you adding it. So if you just sample randomly, you will get the grand average, and that's okay. But when you're doing different treatments, you aren't doing the same thing to different parts of the field. So this might have gotten one crop, and area B has another crop. And now when you plant, had one crop. Now you're planting corn on it, and this corn doesn't look so good. What's going on? Well, if you took two samples rather than this one sample across it, you get much more information. It allows you to troubleshoot what's going on. You can target sampling. And of course, this is a strip trial, cover crop, no cover crop, cover crop, no cover crop. So you can combine these and have two samples, but for research, we'd have A1, A2, B1, B2, we have lots of samples, but a person could just group these A's and B's together and get better information back. All right, so here's the test. I talked a little bit about it. Here's the different categories. This blue arrow here, we do the texture, is the value returned in the lab. Then this color coding, we go from red, orange, yellow, light green, dark green. The idea is we're looking to see where we come out with our score against other soils in that textural class. So we've measured it in indicators. Now we use what's called a scoring function to color code this. That's where the colors come from. This is how it's done. Everyone knows the bell-shaped curve. What we do is we use a mathematical trick to kind of turn that bell-shaped curve. Instead of coming back down on the other side, it goes back up on the other. We just invert it. So halfway through, we invert it. And then we can take a measured value here. If our laboratory returns 55% aggregate stability, I can slide up to the solid line, which is sand, silt, clay, and then slide over and see what my score would be. What color is that in? We moved to 5 colors this year from 3, just to get a little more discrimination, narrow our yellow band a little more so we can actually see, just learn more from it. All right, page 2 talks about this, what this rating of scoring was used 20 to 40, what does it mean? 0 to 20, 20 to 40, 40 to 60, et cetera. Pages 3 through 8 talk about each of the different tests, the aggregate stability. What is it? In simple language, what is it? How do we do it? What's it tell us about what's going on? And then it interprets the score that we got. It is low, so you might want to think of this or that. It's just some beginning text to kind of get you thinking in a direction. Pages 9 and 10, that's where these, we call it a linkage table, management suggestions based on these constraints. So if you're in the red zone for aggregate stability, which we are for the soil, it suggests short-term and long-term management suggestions. It's not a recommendation. Just suggest these are the sort of things that would help, that are known to help that, but you'll have to decide for yourself as you go through your strengths and weaknesses, your resources, to decide what to do. This kind of contrasts those two soils, that A and that B, and it shows these are the issues of the soil. Here's that aggregate stability test. It's in the red zone. It says it's going to affect aeration, infiltration, rooting, crusting, sealing, erosion, and runoff. I guess you can see that. See it from the demo, too. Of course, this soil, the sod, it's all in the green zone. Everything's functioning up to snuff. So this is what we call benchmarking. This is how good this soil could get, and this is how degraded this soil could get if you plowed it every year for 30 years and grew small grains. So most of the time, any normal person, their field will be somewhere in the middle here. But then by having this information, you can say, oh, I've improved from this, or I'm getting back to where I was. So it's, again, the two samples giving you many times more information. And, of course, so here's the test. We use the testing to get the information on the processes. Now what are we going to do? There's these steps. Here's a classroom where we take different reports. We block out the person's name, but we collect information on what their operation is. We kind of come up with best ideas. We shout them back and forth and say, what about this? What about that? And if the grower's there, it's great. If not, it's just an exercise. But this is actually what we expect the grower to do, to kind of isolate his strengths. So you have labor, big family, close to markets, organic, conventional, all these things. How much equipment, what kinds of equipment, what are their goals, what are the issues? You get the results back from the lab test. What does it mean? Where am I low, medium, and high? Then once we have that, we move towards the management. What might I do? A little help with the letter pages of the report there. Then talk it over with the grower. He looks at it and says, oh, no, I don't want to do that. I can't do that. Or I won't do that. It's okay. You refine that and try something. Come up with a plan. Kind of record it there. And then you monitor, see how it worked. Come back, refine it. Talked about this yesterday, these toolbox of management practices in a very mildly diversified system. This is really what all your options are. This. Someone said we can integrate animals. Of course, that in an integrated system, that's what you do is you complicate in a good way. But really, there isn't so much you can do. There's really, everything falls into these categories. And in what your management will be a combination of these, but you think about them in terms of individual things with the idea of you're going to be putting them back together. So the crop rotation, I've got this book over here. Of course, all these great things that crop rotation does, we know all of this. It's kind of given. But what are the ideas, the new ideas? What about new crops, new cover crops? I mentioned yesterday the seed dealers are coming out with booklets like this, what they sell and what it will do. It is a sales pitch, but they're really trying to help you choose the best combination of plants that are available for your crop rotation. Timing, shorter season varieties, create more time for cover crops to grow. And then cover crops. There's a book on cover crops that's only scratching the surface, because cover crops, different ones and different combinations, have all these features, some more or less of each of the features. And depending on your needs, you can, right, the test allows you to line up several birds so that you throw your best stone, is the big idea. Just to illustrate that, here's the soil aggregation. Everyone knows that when you've got this nice sod here, you've got great aggregation here of these crumbs. But if you had it just, if this was instead alfalfa, you'd see more taproots here. You wouldn't see all this great aggregation because the roots structured differently. But you'd get other things from that legume. You might get deeper rooting from that taproot. You might get nitrogen residual. So the idea is that you want to choose particular species that have these functions that you kind of need for your operation. Of course, but this again just puts it in a way to look to remember that it's you that has to choose what to feed the soil, and the better you choose, the more you could get back. And then organic matter, I said before, we always think, oh, we always want organic matter to accumulate because it stores water, it sponges water, stores carbon, holds nutrients right on it. It's spongy, it's light, it's organic matter floats. Soil is 2.6 times heavier than water. So soil sinks like a stone, and organic matter floats. So it lightens the soil, all of those things. It's wonderful, but it's in its broad sense. But we also want the organic matter to decompose because it releases nutrients, glues those aggregates together. So the idea, so how can this work? Well, we don't want to be miserly and we've got only so much organic matter and trying to keep it. We put more on or we grow more. This is the idea with organic growing, is that you're not afraid to take time and grow and feed the soil so that the soil can feed back. And this is what we forget in our more conventional culture. So there's a book on this. This is available free online, real easy to read. Talks a whole lot about this balancing act. And tillage, just a real quick thing about tillage. The no-till is like the minimum effort. It's also the minimum stirring. I don't know who has ever run a wood stove, but you know that if you stir the coals in a wood stove, you get more heat, but it doesn't last as long. Well, that's exactly what happens when you stir the soil. You get a big flush of carbon dioxide coming off after and release of all sorts of nutrients in the soil. But if it's some time and you plant a little seed, that seed could be an infant for some time, quite small, and by the time it gets big enough to use all those nutrients, a lot can be lost. Where the idea is with no-till or reduced tillage, and single pasture, saving a lot of time and fuel and effort. You're not stirring all those coals. You're keeping them there to break down slowly all night long rather than giving the heat before bed. But you are doing a little bit of stirring right where that infant's going to be. So as that little seed comes up, this little bit of stirring and soil disturbance there is ideal because that's releasing all those nutrients for the plant. By the time the plant reaches adolescence, it can go out, its roots go out and get their own food, as this has now started to break down as well. But I wanted to put this in, the single pass planting, this no-till, it sounds great. Why doesn't everyone do it? It's tricky because most of our soils, John Paul mentioned this, are really addicted to tillage. So you need to find out what's going on in your soil first, address those things, come up with a plan, slowly work out of this tillage, this addiction to tillage. A lot of local expertise out there, for tricks, for that soil type or that climate. Lots of new little technologies. I took one of the wheels off the corn planter. This is a piece of Teflon. This is a corn planter. So as it goes along, the seed falls right here. The seed tube, it drops out here, and every 6 inches it's going to plant a seed. But it used to be that it just get pressed in with a wheel back here. You're moving in this direction. But now they've added, since about 2000, they've added this Teflon little shoe that actually rides right in that seed furrow and pushes the seed to the bottom of the furrow. Now those wheels behind just throw soil over, and you get that nice seed-soil contact. So without something like that, no-till looks very splotchy, and it looks like a failed seeding. But this sure helps a whole lot, and I think it's $8 per row to put these on if you didn't have it. So there's lots of little tricks, and the thing about it takes high levels of skill to make it work. You only have one chance across to get a good stand. You're banking everything on that stand returning by the time that matures. And if you don't get a good stand, you can't really get a good yield. So you've only got one chance to go across. So if you only had one time to roll the wall when you're painting, you better have good paint and go very carefully. Rather than go back and forth six or eight times, like conventional tillage, you kind of can smooth out the rough spots. There's a lot of effort that you're putting in to make sure it does cover, but here we're saying I'm doing it one time across. So it's not easy. It's a lot of benefit, but you got to get there. I had to put this in. John Paul talked about this. This is this ripper stripper, this decompactor. This is used to loosen the soil at depth. You determine the depth of a hard layer. Then you can use a tool like this. This is set up now to actually prepare a row for planting. Soil goes through, this goes through the soil, whatever depth you set it at, 2 inches below the hard restricted layer. Then these coulters flow behind, they're open. They pull the soil in, make a little mound. And this rolling basket makes the mound ready to plant. So it's a two-pass planting. This is the first part, you've got your planter. Important to recognize with any of your soil management, soil health in particular, that strategy, you get a lot more return by combining things together. So if you can not just reduce, right, if you just simply reduce tillage, you can, there's a benefit to that. But if you combine the, or cover cropping, there's a benefit. But if you can combine the reduced tillage and cover cropping, you can add some compost, of course. It kind of goes without saying, but it's really this idea of putting multiple things together. You're putting the shoulder of multiple things together to reach the same goal. Here's a green manure cover crop. I'd like to mention that this all this material here could have been harvested away and sold or fed. There's money there. In this case, it was allowed to die. And all that money you could have made is laying right here. Now, when the strip tiller goes through and corn's planted here or beans or whatever, this is the setup for that. There's because this money wasn't taken, you've invested this money in the soil. That's going to give you, if I can use money, that's going to give you more bang back. But this is the sort of strategy that's really worth applying and considering. All the effort sometimes a person might go, with certainly conventional folks, they spend a lot of money collecting all that straw, selling it for sometimes peanuts, and all that effort, when they could have just left it. And that little money they got, that little money could have done them a whole lot of good possibly on the soil. And this is my last slide. It's the soil testing or soil health testing. It's the foundation of this soil management to understand what's going on. But it's just a tool. It's just information. And you really need to follow some sort of a framework to, in the context of your needs, to have all this in mind. You've got to keep all those balls in the air at once, thinking, well, this helps this, and planting this will help that. You've got to keep them all together. That's why we have the six steps where you kind of write it down. You see what the costs are, the benefits, who could help with that, how you could or couldn't do that, not make it work. And you've really got to keep learning. You've got to attend local farm days, field days. You got to read events like this, obviously. But you've really got to just keep learning. Things are happening so fast now, especially. But there's new cover crops all the time. Jean-Paul mentioned one that may have been sun hemp. He called it Corporella, yeah. It's just, who knows where it's from. It's not here. I don't know about it yet. And it's a legume, kind of a tropical legume. What might that do for a niche fitting in with oats or what have you? So you'll hear about it. Someone will be testing it. You'll want to try it. I encourage you to try, but also measure. A before and after or best is side by side, where you set up a nice couple of strips. Just try a strip. Don't go overboard when you try these new things. But do a strip or two. See how it looks. Take a measurement. Where it worked well, you could measure there. Where it didn't work so well, but you did it, you could measure there. And, of course, where you didn't do it, measure there. And, of course, you'll have yields from those places, either visual or actual yield. So it's really information. And the more information you have that you can keep together, the more successful you'll be. So that's all I was going to present on the screen. I've got the demo over here if people care to see that stability test. How much soil are you looking for? We ask for 4 cups, so that's a quart. So think of a quart of milk. All the different tests take a lot of material. It takes about 5 weeks to turn it around. We're really working on that, but we've got two incubations that take a week. We've got to dry the soil before they start. We've done it in 3 weeks, but we're typically backlogged. We're working on that. We think 3 weeks makes sense, but right now it's 5 weeks. Unfortunately, yeah. Not necessarily. We're involved in so many projects. Researchers in other places in the Midwest, there's cover crop trials going on all the time where they do soil health testing under the different cover crops that have been going on for 2 and 3 years now. We see what happened the first year and the second year and the third year, what's working and what isn't. We hear a lot of stories that, the rye didn't have a chance. Well, this year we had great rye, great cover crop growth this fall because we've had a good fall for it. So there's going to be real effects of that cover crop. It's had some time to do it. But if we had snow 3 weeks ago, the cover crop might be just this tall all winter. Then in spring, if we've got a slow spring, you don't have much material there by the time you go to kill it. So you're not going to get that effect, something you can measure. So you really need robust cover crop to have an effect on the soil. And so that's the sort of feedback, just all sorts of trials. We've got our own research project. I showed those strips. We use a cover crop to cocktail and grow corn conventionally, plow till and no-till to see how the cover crop is affecting, that cocktail is affecting the soil parameters.
So if you send in a sample, will that be in the database for when you repeat another sample, or should you send your old sample results with it?
No, that would be kind of on you to do that, but we've got an archive. But we wouldn't necessarily, as a matter of course, say, oh, here's a sample. Oh, we've got one of those before, or have it pop up. Someday we'll have that. In fact, we're working with those folks with the Farm Hub. And we've got quite a database that everyone has access to without any, it's all anonymous data. But the idea is everyone should be able to grab this data and try things and play things. Yep. Well, I mean, you can certainly say I send in last year, and it's a quick, we pull it right up. But I mean, your own notes too should, I would say always take careful notes, exactly where you sampled and why, so that when the results come back, you say, now, why did you take a sample over there? It's $95. There's a lot to learn, but not if you lost track of your question. We've always done it in spring. Spring makes the most sense, but not when it takes 5 or 6 weeks. I think what you're going to find is as time goes on, the wiser folks aren't waiting for the results. They know what to do. Right. So you can plan. Yeah, this sort of information, it is planning information. So I could say that if I'm waiting plants. If I don't plant my corn May 1st because I'm waiting for the lab to give me results back on how much phosphorus to add, I'm out of business. No farmer would ever do that. And so when people need their results fast, it's a homeowner that just they're waiting. What do I go buy to put on my lawn? I don't know what to tell them. That there are places that do just these nutrients very quickly. They turn it over in a week, and that's fine. That's good. And so we've kind of moved away from that. This is more planning. This is where you'd want to do it in the fall. Or whenever you did it, it's just information. Then you say, okay, I've got this going on over there. Imagine if I could put these three birds in a row and think, what stone might I throw to address all of them? I've got some surface hardness, soil structure, and active carbon. So I'd get more of that from fresh material. Maybe manure. That would sure help with the structure and the surface hardness if I could put the manure on without over-compacting the soil. Or I could grow a green manure. Probably I'd think more of a sod-based green manure because that would give me surface compaction relief. It certainly help with my surface structure, soil structure. And the active carbon would benefit from that. When wouldn't you use a cocktail? I can't answer that. I would always use a cocktail. I couldn't imagine, if I was planting a cover crop, choosing one seed and saying this is it. Unless it was something I was going to roll like they're doing with the cereals now, or you're planting oats to winter kill, but soon There'll be some legume you can put in with that oats in August. And when the oats are this tall, when it finally freezes off, so will your legume, whatever that is, be. And then that's all that, whatever the legume does that the oats don't do, whatever that juice has in it, that's going to be in my soil, benefiting me. And if I need that, then I'll have it. So it's, it just, but it helps you target. It gives you something to aim for and why you would choose one cover crop and not another. I often do the thing where you put your finger in your mouth and hold it up and feel which way the wind's going and say, oh, plant clover. We think you should, right, you can't put wind in your sails with that sort of a decision. And this, it's too much work to plant a cover crop and have to be successful to not have a good plan. Did everyone notice that all this soil is gone? Or almost all of it broke down and landed down at the bottom there? This soil, very little if any. Same thing happened with the rain.
So this was the compacted soil.
Yeah.
Wow.
So the rain landed from here down.
Larger?
Not really. No, it's magnified underwater.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit.
But a
little bit, maybe, yeah.
No.
No, they're free downloads.
Okay.
You can have it.
Okay. Are you going to tell us about that?
Yeah, I was going to do the test if people want to see it.
I just looked at this again. Soil microbial abundance and activity.
Low.
In other words, is it overactivity? There's so much activity there, it's low in respiration.
No, that's red. So the soil microbial abundance and activity is not high. It's down in the basement. So you'll want to do something. So what might you do to promote those? Yeah,
okay.
they're needing something.
And here phosphorus is low, too.
In that case, it's high. So low phosphorus is bad, of course. But if phosphorus gets too high, that becomes an environmental risk. So that's one that we score low as you get too high, because if there was a big rainstorm, you had a 40-acre field.
Oh, it's too high.
Too high.
Well, that's what threw me off. It's too high, but yet my chemistry test shows low.
I don't know what to say, huh?
Strange. Okay, it's high.
Is there a history of manure on here or anything?
Yeah.
Or compost? Do you want to see the test?
Yep.
It's kind of neat. So I've got some soil from each of these that have passed through a 2-millimeter sieve. So these are the crumbs from each of these. You can see a little bit different in color. They're different organic matter.
That's
so,
soil.
Yep. So, right, here's where that inch of rain landed. And this doesn't look much different than this. The inch of rain landed here. It all went in. It said, ha ha, big deal. Mm-hmm. No problem. The inch of rain came here. It went from this to this. And you can see this, how thick this crust is. So that the water went that far, but no further. Mm. That's as far as it went. It just made cement. Or I should say concrete. Because concrete is cement plus aggregate. So whatever sand is in here is the aggregate, and the cement is the silt. So the way we test it is we did a rainstorm there of an inch. In our lab, we do a half inch, that's this much, in 5 minutes. So there's 12 5-minute intervals in an hour. So this rainstorm is 6 inches an hour. It's quite a rainstorm, but it's only for 5 minutes, and it's a test. It's like a sprint to see what the soil can take. So on this one. Some of the degraded soil. Of course, we measure this very precisely in the lab. But the idea is we get one layer of soil on the sieve. We weigh it. I'm going to say it's 30 grams. I'll take this one. And this. Oop, I'll do one at a time. It's funny, in the lab we use a special spoon, and the soil actually wants to spread out. This sieve is actually very taut, and I didn't show you, but the size of the holes in this sieve are the size of medium-sized sand. So it looks really fine, but it's the size of medium sand. So all these crumbs that stay on top here are bigger than medium sand, and the dust falls through. So now we weigh it now, and that's our starting weight. Pardon? We're going to watch the rain melt the soil down, just like it kind of did there. Only this is the lab test, so we can actually put a number on that breakdown. You would say this one's not as stable as this one. But what if it was intermediate to that? You'd be hard-pressed to say that it is. How would you determine if it is intermediate? Well, that's what the test is for. It's a standardizer. Move this out of the way. Get this started. This device is just a rainfall. It's a drop generator. So it uses siphon and vacuum to drip at a constant speed for as long as you'd want to for any sort of an experiment. We use it around the lab a lot for stuff and in the field. So if I lift it up and hang it here, no, well, you know, water sticks to itself. And so when water moves down in the profile, it's pulling on all the other water that's there too. So it is a siphon as it moves down, which is why drainage is so important. When people install those tile drains and it takes water away, it's actually pulling not just in the soil in the vicinity of that tile drain, but it's pulling on all the soil, the entire earth that's above it. But, of course, distance and the friction of the soil keeps it from going too far. So it was dripping because there's air in here pressing on the water. So everybody knows there's 15 pounds of pressure in the air right here. It's the weight of the air from here to space. It weighs about 15 pounds at sea level. You go to the top of the mountain, it weighs about 13 pounds. If you go to Death Valley, it weighs, let's say, 16 pounds. So because of that extra air or less air, there's more or less weight. Because it's air, we don't even notice it. We call it zero, right? Just it is what it is. We don't even think about it. But, so that's what was in here a minute ago. But now, you notice it stopped dripping. So that air was in here. There's still air in here, but there's that air's been stretched. So whatever air was in here, as the water was dripping just 10 seconds ago, this water level was going down. And the reason it stopped dripping, because there was a, let's say, 2 gallons of air in here, just went to 2.1 gallons of air from 2 gallons. So you stretch the air, that's a vacuum. So the vacuum in this air, if I had a vacuum gauge here, you could read it, is holding this air, this water now here with no weight. So the water can't drip because it has no weight. When I open this little stopcock here, I'm going to let the air in. Can't get in, that 15 pounds from the sky can't get in except through this tube, down to the bottom of the tube. And you see that tube down there? It's about an inch and a half off the bottom. I can, when it's running, I can raise and lower that tube and let it drip faster or slower, because if I put it way up, then I'm going to have more water, so that I'm going to let the atmosphere in at the bottom of the tube only, not here. So the water between the bottom of the tube and here is always held by vacuum in this thing, and the water down here has no vacuum on it. So we're kind of bypassing this vacuum with this tube. And so that's why it'll drip at a constant speed, because even as this water, right, if this were normally open, as this water level got lower and lower and lower, it drips slower and slower. But that wouldn't help us for a test like this. We want a constant drip. So now, as this water level gets lower and lower, it drifts at the same speed, because this vacuum will change to keep this weightless. But below this, that'll always have weight, the same weight, until the air in here gets lower than the bottom of the tube. So the driving force is this much water, this pressure, as soon as I open it. So let me get this ready. So you'll see a big boom as the vacuum in this air says, it feels this air out here, says, give me that, and it'll pull it right through the water. Ready? So that's that vacuum adjusting itself again and again and again constantly, just like a siphon, in order to keep this vacuum exactly what it needs to be to hold this water, and this water is getting less and less with time. So 19.4. So I read the height off the side of it. And so we've kind of, in the lab, we keep this moving. We do four of these at once. We've got a big one of these. But the idea is you can see how the water drops are boring right through the soil, bringing it down, and the crumbs are saying, oh, no, I can't take it. And they're kind of going to mush. In the soil, in real life, when there's other soil below it, that's what makes the crust. So it would kind of erode, but if it's flat land, all these little particles that are coming out of these crumbs would go in and fill those big pores and make that surface crust that you see. This is the compacted.
So presumably this is going to have more water than this one in that cup.
Same water, more soil in the filter.
Oh, more soil in the filter. Okay.
I'm going to go.
It's going through.
Yep.
And what's this called? What's this called?
This is the wet aggregate stability test.
Okay, wet aggregate stability.
So the soil crumb structure is the idea. So let this one drain out. This one over here.
That's a different from a slate test.
Well, it's kind of the same. It's getting at the same concept. It's just that it's giving you a number. It's very visual. You can see that most of this is gone. It's fallen through here, and we'll let the water drain out. We'll weigh that dry soil. If we put 30 grams on here, we're going to find that there's 26 grams here.
This is because there's nothing to hold it together.
Right. All those goos and glues of a living soil